Yeah, it'll be on his.
The starter here.
Cool. On your day.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. With that gavel, I have just convened the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development for April the 24th, 2017. We are gathered together today for the purpose of a public hearing on House Bill 5019, the Oregon Liquor Control Commission Phase 2 budget presentation. And Ms. Deister, would you get us started?
I would be happy to do that. So, co-chairs and members, what you may have noticed, OLCC alluded briefly to the fact that the governor's budget, of course, recommended resources at a certain level, but their applications are far exceeding what was initially projected for the marijuana program, and the number of licensees is likely to exceed what was initially projected as well. Those factors are driving the need for additional resources in the recreational marijuana program. So they are here today to talk a little bit more about more realistic projections in terms of what they are likely to see, and if you have additional licensing applications and licensees at this level, how many additional enforcement staff, compliance staff, administrative policy and process, hearings type staff, does that then indicate might be appropriate in terms of effectively moving any issues and finding problems within the system, et cetera, so that the laws that we have on the books can actually be effectively enforced with regard to recreational marijuana. So wanted to give folks a heads up about that today.
Representative Rudin.
Yeah, just a quick question. This a lot of this material looks familiar. Is this, are these just updated numbers since we heard it earlier, or am I off base somewhere?
I think, generally speaking, you saw a preview of it in phase one with regard to the marijuana program, and we're here today to take a deeper dive to what's behind some of those numbers that you have seen previously.
Okay. With that introduction, I will ask Mr. Marks and anyone else from Team OLCC to come forward.
Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Gomberg, committee members, for the record, my name is Steve Marks. I'm the Executive Director of OLCC. With me is Will Higlin, who is the newly minted Deputy Director of OLCC, and our economist, Bill Schutte, and of course, Dustin from the CFO's office. So we have an interesting job today, and a job you're not going to see much with any other agencies in state government. We're coming here asking for basically a doubling of the marijuana program. The doubling is based on our experience of fees, but we recognize that this is a complete contrast to the experience you have with the general fund budget and what you're doing. So we are fee funded. And we know that we came back to go through the detail of the work that those positions will be doing for us, the cost of those positions, and the activities that we'll support. So there'll be some review that you saw in phase one, because these are doing similar work, but we're talking about the increment of work these new people will be doing, and we thought we would need to justify that ad completely for you. So with that, we are a self-funded or fee-funded program, and that's a major distinction. And our licensing process drives both the fees to support our program, and also drives an enforcement within our program, and also drives the securing of tax revenues. licensing drives enforcement because that brings the dollars into the agency that allow us to put the personnel out in the field. So there's a timing relationship here. We need to get licenses there so we secure the resources so we have the FT for field enforcement. And then, of course, the enforcement drives our primary objectives, which is compliance with state law and with the COLE memorandum from the U.S. Department of Justice, which focuses on preventing minors from receiving marijuana, preventing diversions, not letting a state system act as a cover for illegal activity and other items. Now, with that and with this moving forward, we have workload challenges. You know, the license applications have doubled. We are beginning for over 1,100 licenses the renewal process this month. So when you think about it, we're going to be doing more work because we're licensing in about, 1,200 or whatever we ultimately get in license applications for this biennium, plus those renewals for folks that we've already licensed. So we'll be doing that beginning in April. Then, of course, we'll be investigating and proposing violations through our field enforcement work. We are moving, as we said in our prior hearing, we're making the decision to move all of the alcohol people and all of the marijuana investigators and inspectors for the field out of licensing because we need them on enforcement. Right now, we are experiencing issues that need the presence of field enforcement.
Yes. Mr. Marks, I'm going to stop you. Yeah. You're at 150,000 feet, and for some of us, I think we want to drop down a little bit and understand better how this is going to work. You've got to get a pig through the python, so that's fine. So you hire a bunch of people. That's going to clear at some point. There are too many vendors right now. I don't know how they're all going to survive out there in dopedom. But at some point in time, you clear this backlog, and we now have 30 new FTE. Can you talk a little bit about are we hiring a bunch of bureaucrats with pencils? Are we hiring a bunch of field guys? If they're field guys, what kind of training are they going to have? Because I'll tell you, there are some places in Jackson County I wouldn't want to show up in my little state-issued Prius all by myself. And so can we get a little more clarity? Maybe I'd take Representative Noble with. Maybe you'd give us some specifics, a little meat to chew on, instead of just up here in kind of la-la land.
So we can jump right to the positions, which is back ways in the slide, or we can review what Bill had presented before, just so you understand where the revenues come from again. We kind of take the high level of the disparity and the gap in our resource and the number of licenses to look at that again? No.
I guess I'm trying to understand, because I've sat in these hearing rooms for longer than I care to remember, listening to some of the liquor folks complain about how long it takes for you guys to process them. So I'm trying to understand what degree of delay is acceptable. What happens to all of these people when you get this backlog pushed through? I just want a little more explanation.
So two things. I think as you go through this presentation, you'll see that we have matched our resources to try to serve all of the licenses there, so we'll get through the backlog. We will raise and secure the revenue through licensing to fund our enforcement in the field, which is going to be extensive. We'll have at that point somewhere north of 2,000 licensees. And the plan, if we're building up to deal with the backlog and the go forward, and if you're worried about the rising support in this, one of the things we built into the process is additional inspectors that can also do licensing. So they'll help on licensing when we start it. We will move them to field enforcement when the program comes together. And then if we look at the total numbers here, we'll try to balance that out, but we don't know how high we're going to grow now. We have the opportunity, because we can close with raising fee revenue, to ensure that we can support the final level here of 37 people.
Are there salary differentials between people that are sitting in an office pushing paperwork versus somebody out in the field. How are you going to differentiate there? Are we paying them at the step that they're out doing, I would assume, fairly dangerous field inspection work? Talk through the details, if you would.
I think maybe we should jump right to Will's part of the program here.
Why don't we jump to page 7? So, co-chairs, member of the committee, for the record, I'm Will Higlin. I'm the, as Steve alluded to, the new deputy director at the OLCC. Thanks for the opportunity today. So directly to your question, what we prepared today was to try to get into the weeds to show you specifically the jobs and the tasks that we need to do as we move forward and how that crosswalks over to the budget request. So I'm going to go over how we're processing the new licenses. You'll see the assumptions around that, and then talk about renewals and talk about reorganizational changes and operational changes. I'll talk about our compliance efforts directly, and then I'll talk about the overall the marijuana administrative budget and the entire ask. So if we get right into the new licensing, you talked about timeline. Right now we're averaging 85 days to process a license.
How's that compare with alcohol?
It's Madam Co-Chair, it is very similar. The difference here, though, I would say there's a little difference. On the alcohol side, as you know, the local governing bodies have up to 45 days to provide input into that process. Here, we just get a Lux report that approves the premise to be licensed within the local jurisdiction. But I can tell you this 85 days, some of them are 30, 35 days, some of them are 160 days. This is the average. The real delta there is dealing with the applicants themselves and trying to get a completed application with all the requirements that we actually ask for. So we go back and forth with them quite extensively.
That just begs another question. Either your form's too complicated or, I mean, if I own a bar, are you coming and sitting with me and helping me fill out the form to get it to a point that's right? Is the expectation that your licensees would fill out the form correctly on the first couple of tries? And I guess the other question that I've got, and I'm sitting next to Senator Monroe, who has been fairly rigorous on this issue, you made a point of saying that local government has an opportunity to comment on the licenses, and I know that that has been a matter of some rub with local government, where they're dealing with facilities that have become nuisances or could become nuisances. When do we get a point where local government gets to have any input into whether or not something should be relicensed?
Madam Co-Chair, I'll talk from, I don't know if you're asking both marijuana and alcohol or specifically marijuana here.
I blended the two rather handsomely for you. What I want to do is to figure out how your marijuana compares with your alcohol and whether or not alcohol is now the stepchild that's getting sort of neglected while you turn all your attention to helping the marijuana folks. I'm trying to understand what's the duration of time if I'm a barkeep someplace, recognizing that there is a local process for comment. But I'm just trying to figure out, are you treating the marijuana folks and the alcohol folks comparably?
Madam Co-Chair, I believe the answer to that is yes and no. And the reason I say that is on the marijuana side.
It's about as clear as my question.
Well,
thanks.
To be very specific, because I know that's what you want, on the marijuana side, we have a lot more regulations. There's security requirements. There's operational requirements. We have to go do a site visit to see what their canopy size is to make sure they're following all those regulations. When I talked about the time it takes on the marijuana side, that's what drives the time. Sometimes we'll get called and say, I'm ready to be visited and have a site inspection for final approval. We'll go out there. They won't even be close, even though we've talked over the phone and tried to educate them. Some of them are more sophisticated, and you go out the first time, and they're ready to roll. They've contracted out. They've got their security system in place, their operational plans in place, and we can go through one site visit, get them approved, and get them licensed. Other times, frankly, it just takes some time. Again, some people in the industry maybe not as sophisticated as others. They haven't dealt with regulation before. And it's cumbersome at times. We do our best to educate, to help, and to handhold to get them into the system.
Okay. Thank you. Please continue.
So on our investigator side, we're averaging 30 cases. It's a lot. So we have all our investigators statewide that maintain a caseload of 30. So when we issue one license and they drop to 29, we reissue another case right at the same time. So they're multitasking. They're averaging between 10 and 11 approvals a month, and as we alluded to at the very beginning, we're expecting to process about 1,500 new applications this biennium.
Stop and say that again. You're doing 10 to 11 a month?
Per investigator.
Oh, okay.
For investigator, I'm sorry. And we're processing, or plan on processing about 1,500 new applications during this biennium. So that total tax will be a roughly $9 million when you include the application of the application fee of about $250, or it is $250. So based on those assumptions, there's really two primary workload issues here on this side, and that is a centralized process with support through administrative specialists and their work. Well, I'll just go through their work. So as you know, or if you didn't know, we put an online application system in to support the marijuana program. So it worked great. So that's great news. But it allowed us to centralize licensing from an administrative standpoint because everything's online. So we have a centralized process internally in Milwaukee with staff that go through, and you can see it on the slide here. They screen the application, track down the missing information, they answer all the questions the applicants might have, and they ensure the application is complete. They also coordinate medical inventory transfers with OHA. They work with the local government on the land use compatibility statements based on approval or denial of the application. And they make sure the applicants within the local jurisdiction don't have any violations with local codes. The other piece of huge work that we've accomplished and will continue to accomplish, which sometimes goes unnoticed, is the worker permit program. Everybody in the industry that touches the product has to go through and get a worker permit, similar to what we do on the alcohol side with the Server's Ed program. We've already issued about 14,000 permits this biennium. Now, based on the growth, we expect to do about 29,000 this biennium. So when that work is completed, based on resources in the field statewide, those applications are delegated out to the investigators in the field. So you can see what they do there. They have background checks. They review the security plans, the operational plans, the ownership structures, the finances of the individual, contributors over 10% of the business, where the funds came from, the premise outlay, the boundary, site inspections, their lease and deeds, the canopy side that I mentioned earlier, the cultivation plan, their electricity and water use estimates, local fire code approval, ODA food establishment license, and they work with ORLAP certification to make sure that they've got the certification if they're a lab. Any questions on that?
We've got two. Let's start with Representative Nierman, please.
I'm just going to use a dumb question of the day here.
I already got that one.
What is a marijuana canopy designation? Talk to me about our marijuana canopy.
Co-chairs, Representative Nierman. Those are the license types. We have different sizes of canopies that individuals might apply for. So in simplistic terms, for an outdoor grow, for instance, there's a tier one and a tier two. Those are significantly different. One is smaller than the other. The costs are different. So they determine that what size they want as far as a canopy. So we don't do plant count. We do canopy size. So within that canopy, that's where all the marijuana needs to be grown.
Can I just follow real quick?
So the
canopy is the leaf structure of the plants then, right? It's not like a physical piece of steel and canvas, or what is it? I don't understand what's going on there.
That's correct, Representative Nairn. So we're really talking about all the plants have to be within a square footage. That's the canopy size. And we'll say we have a 40,000-foot outdoor, and it corresponds to indoor, so we have several different sizes of indoor and outdoor.
Thanks.
And then Representative Reardon.
Thank you, Chair. I'm kind of obsessing over this 85 average days to process a new license, and I believe I heard you say somebody that came in, everything's all lined up, it'd be about 35 days, and then a little slower bunch might be 160 days. So it sounds to me like we are paying for what I would call the cost to correct this. There's errors that are occurring in the application, and it's causing a lot greater amount of time and a lot greater amount of your time. So could we not just say that we only accept really pristine applications that have been well thought out, and then leave the market out there to find a consultant or somebody to do the service that you're providing?
So co-chairs, members of the committee, let me see if I can answer that. So we try our best to get a completed application working over the phone or through email through our licensing system. Mm-hmm. So we don't go out and do site visits until we suspect, because they've told us that they're ready. Sometimes those don't connect, to your point. I'm not sure how we fix that. When you talk about delays, though, I would guesstimate that when I mention delays, it's not so much of us paying and going back and forth as it is the industry trying to figure out how to fill out a complete application and working with their attorneys or whoever they might to get the application complete, and frankly, the priority of it. You know, a lot of people applied right at the beginning and then do anything for 3 or 4 months. The application just sat there in the system because they weren't motivated for whatever reason. I can't answer that question. Some were very motivated to get through the process as fast as they possibly could, but others weren't. So we just dealt with that. But to your direct point, we do the best we can. We don't just run out to every single site back and forth to try to get people in compliance. We really try to do that through our investigators internally in the office. And then once we feel like the applicant is ready, we push that out to the inspectors to go out to the site to do the final site inspection. Did that help at all?
And follow up.
I think it did. If I heard you saying, correct me if I didn't hear it correctly, but you're not paying for a lot of handholding.
I would agree with that.
And if I may, I just want to add to this. This is a brand new program, so there weren't a lot of SEC consultants that knew our rules. We were developing along the way. We had to interpret our rules for ourselves as we were doing this the first time. So that was difficult. The other thing with part of the delay is it could be that we're out there and we say, you need to have this lock fixed, you need to change that fence, and this building, we want to come and inspect it when you say it's up and ready and operating. So it sits and waits before we'll license them until they get a contractor out there to do the work in some cases here.
One last question.
Follow up.
Then, do you track the number of hours per application? So do you know that how much time is actually being put in on a particular on each application so that you can eventually figure out if there is an element of waste and who should be paying for that waste?
Co-chairs, Representative Reardon, I don't believe we track hours, but we do track days. So within the licensing system, we can see where, so you can get there.
Sure.
We have not spent a lot of time doing that right now, trying to just implement the program, to be honest with you. You know, we pulled these high-level data so you could see what average it's taking us to get licenses through the system. But, yeah, we do have that data within the system.
Okay. Great. Thank you very much.
Yep.
I guess I'm struggling with the same thing. I lived in a world for 20 years where we had compliance visits from the FAA all the time. And if you screwed up on your compliance visit, you went right to the bottom of the line, and you were lucky that anybody lifted a finger to come and see you again until they rotated all the way through the ones in front. And I'm just trying to figure out, is there any rigor and discipline in this? Are you hand-holding some people's application to the point that you've got someone from OLCC camped at their grow? Or is there an expectation that these, you know, legitimate businessmen that want to be in the system have the wherewithal to fill out the form?
So, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, that's a great question. But on the policy side of this, remember that our job was to attract people to a highly regulated system from markets that were less regulated and legal. So we wanted to make it as easy as we could for them to join the legal business community, the tracked cannabis system that was COL compliant. And we worked very hard to ensure that they had all the information they need to be able to comply with a new complex set of rules that we had just put into place.
Okay, that's fair. Oh. Okay, please continue. Wherever we've dragged you off.
I think we're on page 8. So we've talked a lot about the licensing process we go through. I believe Director Marks mentioned this at the beginning, but as we look at the totality of the program, we're talking about doubling licenses. You've heard that a lot. The thing I wanted to stress is that licenses have doubled, but this does not include the renewal process we're going through now, we're just starting, and moving to compliance efforts at a greater demand. So I'll cover some of that. So as we go through renewals, we had to make some assumptions here. We don't know. Based on, I believe we issued our first license last year was April 26th or 7th. So we're just getting into the renewal process. So far, to my knowledge, everybody that's been eligible for a renewal has requested a renewal. So we're anticipating that we're going to get a 90% renewal rate. I have no idea sitting here if that's actually what's going to happen, but based on what we've seen and what we've heard, we believe that will be accurate. We also believe, based on anecdotal information, that businesses are going to change because it's a brand new program. So we have a lot of people that are changing tiers. Maybe they were a smaller tier and they want to grow, or they're going to build a new structure on their environment, a drying room or facility, what have you. They might have different ownership, so they're going to make a lot of changes. All those things I've just described will cause us to do another site visit, which causes us the most time and energy as we go through the licensing system. So as we go through renewals, we're anticipating that at least 50% of the applications, we're going to have to go back and do another site visit again to verify that their security measures are in place, that their security plans are in place. And you might ask why, and frankly, I would say it's really for the integrity of the system. The security system that's on site, along with our CTS tracking system, along with our inspectors, is really how we hold the industry accountable to our regulations. And without one of those, we would struggle. So it's important, if people are making changes, that we still go out, make sure they have camera coverage over the entire marijuana operation and things like that. So not to harbor on that, but it's just turned out to be a big, big deal. We anticipate that it's going to be a big deal as we move forward, and we'll have to staff that accordingly. As far as the tasks associated with that, I won't go through all the details.
I'm going to interrupt you again, Representative Noble.
Yep. Thank you. I have a question. This is actually back to one of those, maybe combining the alcohol and marijuana issue, and specific to an issue that's going on in Yamhill County right now that you may or may not be aware of, between viticulture and marijuana grows, and how much, knowing a little bit of the process of alcohol and how it impacts neighborhoods and neighbors, is there anything currently, and I apologize for not knowing all the rules, but currently now that would allow you to consider the impact on neighboring facilities with regard to marijuana or processing?
Sure, I'll give it a shot. So in terms of, you mean, grow side, it's not just processing, actually, because processing is a term of art in our system.
Well, actually, with both.
Both.
And this is a neighboring vineyard, and the arguing of the susceptibility of grapes to take on odors and smells.
So I think one of the policy intellectual arguments that was made is if this was, we wanted an EFU lands where, a lot of our viticulture takes place, that marijuana was really not different than farming. Granted, it's a Schedule I drug that's being farmed. But they would have generally the same rights and opportunities within EFU land. So that means, for wineries, dealing with the problems of your neighbors, right, if you're in EFU lands. Now, some of the rural residential, it gets a little different, but that was sort of the policy take at the high level, where we've come into some conflicts directly with the OLCC system is really how to keep this licensure of alcohol production and marijuana production separated. We have been focused on that, but there's legislation out that would consider being able to do events out in those wineries or being able to do events out on the marijuana grows. Mm-hmm. Likewise. So we'll see what happens with that legislation here, but that would obviously create new problems in the rural areas.
How much are you anticipating this becoming a conflict? I'm thinking about GMO and the fight that we've had here, and errant seeds headed into an organic facility. And I'm just trying to understand how much are you prognosticating the problems that arise from Representative Noble's question, in addition, the public nuisance questions. I'm already hearing from people where there is errant odor, not necessarily something that would adhere to a wine grape or would change the character of an organic facility.
So I'm co-chair members of the committee. I'm not sure that I anticipate a lot of new conflicts developed out on the EFU that aren't resolved. I mean, even the odor, drift odor, is, sort of within our structure of the farming regulations. I do think that that is a different social problem in the residential communities and residential grows, where that conflict with dense housing is going to be a serious problem, and I'm not sure that we have good answers for diminishing the odor that crosses out of my backyard into someone else's smell zone.
Well, I would just observe that that happens all the time.
Yes.
We saw an assault in this session on the dairy industry. Mm-hmm. And I think that you would probably do well to begin anticipating what could be the ramifications before there's a lawsuit staring you in the face.
I did want to say, members of the committee, that you know a lot of the germination issues was really that were talked about 2 years ago had to do with hemp and marijuana conflicts specifically, and I was pretty invested in that whole difficulty of how you would cite products that may be cross-germinated, cross-pollinated. But I'm finding more and more that licensees actually want to grow hemp products adjacent to marijuana products. So I think they're growing clones that are already sexed in the marijuana field, so they don't have that problems. But just like rural agriculture, where you have problems, you know, the Department of Agriculture works with the different industry members, and they try to cooperatively sort of find the distances between grow operations.
And when the whole thing blows up, they come in here and drop it on the legislature, and we're supposed to pick which one of the children we like the most.
Correct. Yes.
Okay, moving along.
Okay, I believe I was at administrative specialist, so I won't belabor this. The process here for renewals is very similar to what we do with a new license. We have that centralized in Milwaukee, make sure the applicant has filled out all the appropriate paperwork. We have to check to see if there's any business structure changes or what have you. Work with the local governments to make sure there aren't any violations with local code. So we'll do an investigation on that renewal process to make sure they're ready to roll. If they need a site inspection, it'll go out to the inspectors to do a site inspection. If not, we can issue from Portland. And the other thing they're doing within that role as well, like I mentioned earlier, is process the marijuana worker permits.
How do you deal with counties where there may be sort of a vague rendition of what some of their land use is? We've got 36 counties. Are your folks supposed to be expert in what Malheur County's zoning issues? I mean, how much original research are you guys going to be doing to try to answer some of these land use conflict questions?
Madam Co-Chair, let me be direct on the operational side. Steve might have a different answer from just managing that at a higher level, but for us specifically, it's all about the land use compatibility statement. So if we get an approval from the local jurisdiction, we move on it, we go. If we have some questions, we might reach out to the local jurisdiction to make sure that what we see is what they're saying as far as approval or denial, but that's really the black or white piece of information that we need to process the license.
Okay, thank you. Senator Hanson.
Along those lines, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Minimum lot size on different EFU crops, weather conditions and stuff. Are you guys addressing that at all with the marijuana production?
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, no, but I think our sizes are under an acre to begin with. Our largest grows about an acre right currently. So we wouldn't fall under most minimum lot sizes. They're out in either rural zones or EFU. That doesn't mean that we don't have some growers that have extensive plans into the future. And in some cases, while one applicant can have one marijuana license on their parcel land, another licensee, independent of the first in the ownership, could also be cited on that same land. But we use county code in citing that. They would have to sign off on the LUX before we would allow the second license or the third license if it was a particularly large piece of property.
Follow up.
Just more out of curiosity, just then really necessarily germane here, but get an opportunity to ask the question. Wheat production's bushel per acres. What is marijuana production, and what would an acre of marijuana produce? as far as volume and or return?
I'll leave the answer and the numbers to Bill, or we can get you the numbers for different kinds of production by different kinds of acreages or canopy size, but it varies based on methodology, indoor, outdoor. See a green cultivation where you have smaller plants. If you're growing large outdoor plants that, you know, the old OMMP system really encouraged because you had six plants and you wanted to maximize those plants' growth, under our system that incentive is gone. So we'll see some changes there, but Bill might have some specifics to add here. If not, we'll get them for you.
For the record, Bill Schutte, economist with the Liquor Control Commission. I could try to do the math in my head, but I won't. We do have quite a bit of information coming out of our cannabis tracking system on average yields per plant, both indoor and outdoor, so we can develop some scenarios and provide them to the committee as to what the average yields are coming out from those different types of scenarios out there.
Thank you.
Okay.
On this slide, I believe I'll just end with the last bullet here, which I think you recognize, but we're a fee-based system. So as we talk about renewals, revenue and compliance are significantly impacted if renewals aren't processed in a timely manner. So that's something we're focused on, to get these things processed, to get them issued, so we can actually generate the revenue to support the overall program. And moving on to compliance. So I'll just start with our assumptions. So as we built the program back at the original budget, we estimated that we'd have one inspector per 100 licensees. We anticipate that they'll spend at least 80% of their time in the field.
Why'd you decide that was the right number? And what happens if I'm the guy that is driving to Malheur County as, and I'm not picking on Malheur County, it's right, just the farthest away. What if I'm the guy that has my 100 cases in Malheur? Am I going to be expected to live there? Am I going to be expected to drive down there, you know, twice a week? How's 100 the right number? We hear constant lamentations from DHS about how their caseload is explosive and overburdening the workers. Why is 100 the right number?
I'm going to give this a shot, and Schutte's probably going to correct me because Bill built the budget originally before my time.
Yeah, but flip it to him.
Co-chairs, I can tell you that it's an arbitrary number. We're taking a shot at it. We looked at Washington, Colorado to see what their enforcement efforts were look like and what the ratio is there. To answer your broader question about the rural areas, we just do that through flexibility. You know, honestly, maybe within the Bend region that covers all of eastern Oregon, maybe they don't have 100, maybe they have to have 60 because of the tribe time and things like that. So we can still have flexibility within that. That's the base assumption, that we want to do one per 100, and then we have flexibility within that. As we've done enforcement and licensing this past 2 years, we have moved people across the state to support those efforts just based on workload. And workload has come in different across the state. You know, Southern Oregon was our big push to begin with because of the outdoor grow season. We didn't have the resources down there, so we had to shift resources down there to help out to get that part of the licensing up and going.
And when you say ship resources, are you telling Agent Marks that he's now moving from Portland to Grants Pass?
Madam Co-Chair, I wouldn't say we have not moved anybody, but we've asked people to go down for a period of time to support those efforts. For whatever, and there hasn't been long period of times, maybe for a week we might send somebody down because we have a whole bunch of site inspections in Medford and we only have two people down there, so we're going to send four people down there to assist to get that work done, so they'll go down and do it and then they'll come back to their regular job.
Okay,
great. So we're anticipating they'll be in the field 80% of the time. As you know, we've talked about, the inspectors are assigned to regional offices, which has actually helped us quite a bit because they have been involved in licensing from the beginning. They've built relationships within the community. They know their local law enforcement. They know the licensees themselves. So they're familiar with the questions, the territory, and frankly, that's helped us building a team kind of community or communication link down there, or down there within all the regions. The one big unknown to me, and it's on the list here, is the unexpected, and we've hit the unexpected several times already, and I think there's more to come. And what I mean by that is, I'll give you an example, is we had a place up in the Portland area that it was complaint driven. We found out somebody had about 1,600 pounds of marijuana. There was no security system in place. They weren't meeting any of our regulations, and so we had to jump on it. The first thing we had to do was work with local law enforcement and state police to figure out if we were doing a criminal investigation or if this was going to be an administrative function. Once those things were determined, we had to get control of the marijuana. So we had to secure...
Who determined it?
Who determined...
Whether you were an administrative enforcement or a criminal enterprise?
Senator Johnson... I think you would find throughout the state, it depends on the local jurisdiction, whether the DA is going to prosecute, whether they want the case or don't want the case. So we have those discussions with the local community to see if we have support. If not, we'll take it on as administrative action. If we do, if they want to, you know, press charges and go criminal, then we'll stay out and let the criminal investigation move forward without us.
And I would just add to Will's answer. We found out there's a complication. You know, we can get an administrative warrant, but if there is criminal investigation going forward, the criminal side has to get their own warrant on that, so we've got to be able to justify them moving forward on it.
Are you guys keeping track of some of these discovered issues in the brave new world of marijuana? Because maybe there are statutory changes that could be effectuated to relieve some of the ambiguity and...
Madam Co-Chair, exactly, and yes, we are, and these are some of the more difficult situations that we face is when law enforcement isn't going to take it on and we're left with it because we want to default and make sure that it stays in the legal system. We want to make sure that we prosecute all cases where we can, but if law enforcement doesn't take on some cases, then we're looking to make it up in some way on our side. I have broad statutory authority under our statute to, I mean, the mandate is to support, you know, to keep product out of the illegal market. And we've worked hard to do that on these circumstances. But they're tricky, and we are keeping track of them. And we are seeking some statutory remedies that will help us in these cases currently.
What do you do when you have the coincident of counties, let's just say hypothetically a coastal county that starts with a C and ends with a Y, where you've got the coincident occurrence of practically no law enforcement and it happens to be prime growing territory? Jackson, Josephine, Curry, any of the rest of those down there in the marijuana belt that have, by anybody's assessment, inadequate law enforcement. How do you sync that together so you're not playing police for the whole Southwest Coast?
I'm chair members of the committee. The reality of that is you know, every time so far to date that we've needed law enforcement to pay attention to our activities and ask for their assistance, we've received it. Either from locals or state police has been available to us to follow up on those investigations. That doesn't necessarily mean the DA is always going to charge, but we have had coordination when we've needed it in the initiation of this program.
Okay.
So my final point there was, in the example we were talking about, we actually tracked the time it took four staff members about 32 hours to make sure that we secured the product with evidence tape, weighed it to make sure we knew what was on site. The reason I bring that up is we talk about the ratio of 1 to 100, but we are going to have these instances like this one that's going to take an extreme amount of staff time, and we don't even know what those look like yet. So every time we get one, we have to huddle, figure out a strategy. How do we want to deal with this? We'll get better as we do this more often. I think it'll become operational, but it's going to be a big issue to us because it already is. So moving forward, we'll have a lot more of those. As far as the marijuana compliance inspectors, their tasks and duties, as you can imagine, they're doing the site visits we talked about for new licenses, renewals, make sure the canopy site is appropriate, and any other compliance work. We do minor decoy operations. We coordinate, as we've talked about, with local law enforcement. This one is very important to us, although it seems soft, is investigate citizen and local government complaints and concerns. So the OLCC now is really the trap line for all the questions that people have about cannabis in the state. So when somebody stumbles across any type of grow, the call comes to us. We've had limited resources at this point to deal with a lot of those efforts. We can tell people if it's a recreational grow, but because of statute limitations between us and OHA and privacy rules, we can't notify them if it's a medical grow. We don't know if it's an illegal grow. But we've decided that because we're getting all of these calls that we would like to actually grab this issue, create a hotline that we're putting in place now, actually advertise this number so people know where they can call for questions, and then we have an obligation to work with local agencies, with local law enforcement, to make sure we close the loop, because I'm afraid that there's so many questions around marijuana in the state of Oregon right now, the loop never gets closed, and we want to close that loop to find the appropriate answer so we can get back to those people that are asking the question.
So many of our state agencies are complaint driven. How do you prioritize a complaint in the plethora of calls that you're taking? They come to the first of the queue, the back of the queue, whenever we get around to it?
Madam Co-Chair, I'm not certain. I'm sorry if I understand your question. As far
Mr.
as
Mr. Marks does, punt to him.
Punt. Well, first, we don't have this call center up, but we receive calls like this all the time. One, we try to answer them ourselves quickly. If it's something that we think there's, you know, some interpretation, some confusion, we have an extensive website with a lot of materials. We might direct them there to find and get answers to understand if we understand their problems. Secondly, if it involves the allegations of any criminal activities, we're on it. That's an important priority, obviously. Those go to the top. When it's coordination and information about a land use dispute, those are the things that I think, or, you know, what kind of marijuana is next to you? Those are the harder questions to get quick answers to in some way and harder to prioritize in some way because we don't control the resolution of those answers all the time, and specifically with medical grows, that information has to involve, and we can get involved to get the system to work. We have to have law enforcement ask the question so we can get the answer back locally to those that need it to follow up. But I'd say that's the general sketch of them. We get a lot of calls, though. Most of them are handled in the first instance by staff quickly. I mean, we were getting in the order of, we had two people answering phones when we were licensed in every day for, and they were dealing with hundreds and hundreds of phone calls and emails daily.
Still do.
The reason for my query, colleagues, is that because, oh, let's just say DSL is completely complaint-driven, if somebody sees somebody with a shovel standing near a ditch, they dispatch the full might of the state of Oregon, police cars screaming up to bust the poor defendant. And I'm just trying to figure out whether or not people that are calling to complain in your system get the same rapid response that DSL dispatches regulators to the scene of the crime. You don't need to respond. You can continue your presentation.
Okay. Thank you.
As far as another, you know, we talked about this philosophically about the inspectors, is we're trying to educate first and regulate second, as long as it's not egregious. So as we get calls in, just like we were talking about, and we go out to a site where they might be out of compliance with issues that we feel are really a training issue, there was no real intent, we want to train people, get them in compliance, but that's the ceiling then, and then we'll go back, and we expect that they will maintain that level of compliance. If it's egregious things that are obvious, you know, they're just trying to divert product or whatever it might be, we would take a different stance. Some might question that. That goes back to trying to actually support the industry and encourage people to stay out of the illegal market. So we want to open our arms to that. We want to educate first and enforce second. And then finally, lastly, the inspector's right violations are really reports and assist in preparing and representing cases at administrative hearings for licensee and worker permit violations.
Representative Noble.
Thank you. So a question about enforcement.
Yeah.
And it's probably related to the first time around hearings. And I'm just used to OLCC having limited police powers when it comes to alcohol, and wondering how much more effective you could be if you had similar police powers with regard to marijuana. My experience is that the interaction with local police doesn't change. It's just it gives you more ability to maneuver through the process and choose the right course of action, be it enforcement or administrative sanctions.
Let me take this one, Madam Chair, members of the committee. So I just talked a philosophical level. You know, right now the way the marijuana program is put together is we have enforcement only through our licensees. That's it. When you talk about the dangers within the industry or potential risks within the agency, our training and our response to our staff is don't go to dangerous situations. If you feel like you're going to somewhere that's dangerous, you should get local law enforcement involved to back you up. We don't want to put our staff in those types of situations just because they don't carry those types of protection. But that's really a philosophical thing that we've managed to about education and compliance. And if you run into a situation that you deem dangerous, don't go and get backup from local law enforcement.
Yeah, my experience with on the alcohol side is the same. Even if you are police officers and have all the same tools and training for that respect, is if it's a dangerous situation, you'd still bring in local law enforcement. But specific to marijuana, just curious how, if that would impact the ability to be efficient in what you have to do with regard to administrative or criminal sanctions.
Members of the committee, I don't believe so. And part of this, and first, don't believe so. Two, we weren't statutorily empowered to do more for a reason. We wanted to be able to get on site to have some trust that we were an administrative system so that we could work directly with growers, so we'd have good access to the growers, particularly on the grow side. You know, it's a little different when you're dealing with retail and otherwise. But I don't think it inhibits our ability at all. And as I said, law enforcement has been there and backed us up every time we needed them. In some circumstances, it may be, and we haven't come across this, but we can't go into the primary residence at a grow. That's just no for us. So if there's something that there's probable cause to be investigated, and because of our folks there, we've got to go to law enforcement to make that happen, that's probably an efficiency area that's specifically ruled out for us in statute for maybe some obvious reasons, but maybe not. But they didn't want the intrusion of the home by someone who is, you know, partially trained within DPSST, that had a higher ordinance of privacy, and that a warrant by a law enforcement agency would be gauged to be the appropriate way to get there. That's probably the main inhibition or a limitation, I guess, we have by not having full enforcement powers in the field. There's probably others police professionals could identify here, but that's one of the ones that we actually debated around in the policy committee.
Follow up?
No.
Okay.
Please continue. Slide number 10. So I wanted to set this stage a little bit just to give you the current situation. So in the current marijuana budget, as it relates to public safety, and that's the investigators, inspectors that we've spoken much about today, there are 11 positions currently. As you know, we had an all-hands-on-deck because of the number of licenses we received, and we put our alcohol resources and everybody we could on the licensing of marijuana. And that, frankly, we've been pretty successful. So we got to the 1,200 licenses we have now, but we've ignored some of our core duties as an agency. One of those being the alcohol people need to go back and do their alcohol jobs. We need to be doing work in compliance and alcohol. We need to get enforcement, more staff and resources out to do the enforcement work or compliance work with marijuana. So where we sit today, as I talked to you about the 11 resources we really have for the marijuana budget, as you know, we have DPSST certification that's mandatory by statute. Those individuals are in training right now. So the plan right now when they come out is there's going to be 11 coming out. 8 of them are going to the compliance arm of marijuana, and 3 will continue to licensing with marijuana. And the folks that have been supporting marijuana in the alcohol program will be going back to really support their jobs and doing the regular jobs that they're assigned to do.
I should know the answer to this. I don't. Do you background check these folks, and are they allowed to have any interest in the industry?
Madam Co-Chair, I believe the answer is yes and no.
Thank you.
So to set that stage, when we talk about resources, they're limited. We've got, now we go back to the whole thing, double licenses, we've got renewals, we've got the compliance effort, so here's our ask. So we'll get into some numbers here. So we're asking for 10 new marijuana license investigators. We're asking for 60 new marijuana compliance inspectors. We anticipate that we're going to get another 1,500 applications, and we'll do about 2,600 renewals. Remember, they're annual licenses, so we're starting the renewal program now, or process now, and then we'll do it again before the end of the biennium. So we'll have 2 rounds of renewals during the biennium.
Given that DAS has been unable in all the time I've been here, despite promises, to do a comprehensive compensation study. Who set the compensation level for these folks, and what is it?
Staffs.
Yeah, we did the results.
Based on what?
The department. They did a hay analysis on both these jobs. We had both the inspectors and investigator positions recently reviewed by DAS to ensure their classification was right. It was asked for by the union on these positions, and I think they were hoping to get a higher classification for the inspectors. We have decisions coming forward on them. There is a we've got to negotiate how in the end how that's going to work with the union. But they came up with a scheme that really bifurcated what had been equal pay for investigators and inspectors, and now the inspectors' differential would be higher than the investigators, and that's a problem within the agency. We have people that are positioned around this issue, but we'll have to deal with it based on our negotiations on it.
That leads back to one of the first mm-hmm. questions that I answered. If you don't know what the classification is and you're asking for this many additional people, how do you know the economic impact? What's the fiscal here?
So the assumption we made here was to put more of the weight on the inspectors, which also have more flexibility because they can do licensing, but they can do inspections. So that's why we asked for 16 there on the enforcement side. So that's the way we, in anticipation that we might have a bifurcation here in status, and that's the reason why we asked for those people on that line, because we just couldn't cross-utilize all of them like we did before, so we've anticipated that. Will it work out perfectly? We hope so, but we've at least tried to address that in our ask here.
So if Senator Monroe decides that he wants a new career as a dope inspector, what should he expect to be remunerated at what level?
Bill, you get that?
We're just looking out for your best interest.
Yes. Hopefully,
for the record,
I get
Bill Schutte, economist, I believe the regulatory specialists are 27s, 27 level. We'll double check on that to make sure, but I don't know what the result of the classification study is or where they might move after that.
Bill deals with the all-in price, so he knows that, but I don't know their specific salary. I get the all-in price in my head, but not their salary.
When is the conflict with the unions going to be adjudicated?
Prior to the end of the biennium.
Okay.
Continue. The next line is we're asking for two management positions, one specifically to manage the licensed investigators and the investigations, and the other to manage the enforcement activities and the marijuana compliance inspectors. Just for note, the OLCC is currently under the current management ratio of 1 to 11, and with this additional staff and these two management personnel, we would still be within that ratio. And then some other tasks, the compliance specialist we alluded to throughout the presentation, this is really in support of the inspectors out in the field. They analyze the cannabis tracking system data. This is critical. Again, this is one of our big components or the backbone to our security, so things in the system can be flagged, which has happened before. I'll give you an example. I think it came before this committee as information, but we had, it was a training issue for the most part, but we found something in the cannabis tracking system where about 145 of our producers out of about 300, almost half at the time, were out of compliance with the specific element of the tracking system, not to get into the gory details. We were able to pull that information and actually through writing bulletins and training, we got that number down to 39. That were actually in violation. And so we did what we've talked about. We tried to educate to get people in compliance. They didn't get into compliance. We're going through the administrative process with those last 39 as we speak. The other place where people get a lot of their information and training, we mentioned it, is our website. We've had over, what's the number? I've got it down. 4 million people have contacted our webpage since the beginning of the process, which is, you know, truly amazing. But the frequently asked questions, all the licensing questions, not just from the citizens of Oregon, but for our licensees, there's a whole bunch of information. We really try to drive people there. out of this system that I just described. So they work closely with public safety, and they'll work with the managers to actually delegate out to the managers places where they think looks suspicious, and we need to do follow-up as far as a site inspection to make sure everything is in compliance. And last but not least, they do a lot of the statewide reports and the public information requests that come into the agency. I'm almost done here. The next page, we talk about our administrative policy and process, our hearings unit. So if you're not aware, it's like our internal DA office. So what happens is we do inspection work out in the field. The inspectors will write a report, a violation report. It'll go to our administrative process hearings division. They evaluate the report. They'll draft the violations internally there and denial notices for licensees and permittees. They interview the witnesses, and then they prepare the cases. The cases then are presented to the Office of Administrative Hearings. They present case to commission for adoption of the final order. So it goes from the hearings office in front of our OLCC commission for final order. And then they work directly with our inspectors to make sure that those actions are followed up out into the field. So that gives you an idea of how the process works.
You have taken over time special care to make sure that your commission has representatives that understand all aspects of liquor distribution and consumption. I mean, you've had people that own hospitality establishments. If your commission is the court of final review for an ALJ decision, are you going to make any effort to find a seat for someone who is familiar with the cannabis industry to bring that perspective to commission deliberations?
So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, there has been discussion about that and proposals to manage having a cannabis industry member on the commission. Former Chair Patridge was very resolved that having a cannabis member have full voting authority over liquor matters was not a good idea because it is still marijuana Schedule One drug, and we have federal regulatory oversight over our liquor distribution. We had attempted in sort of working with policy committees in the industry to balance out how you might bring a cannabis viewpoint and cannabis issues in front of the commission by allowing a ex officio chair of an advisory committee to sit on the commission. We also propose that the alcohol member that's currently allowed conflicts today also be made ex officio and chair the alcohol advisory commission to balance it out, expanding to from a 5 to a 7 member board. That has kind of gone by the wayside. So I would just be politic and I think say this. The new approach I think that's espoused in the policy committee is to expand the commission with a member from the east side and a member from the west side. We retain the alcohol conflict position. That will give the governor some discretion in picking a chair and balancing out all of the needs of the commission. The governor will have to take that responsibility and forward it to the Senate for confirmation and balance it internally.
Even just the notion of advisory committees would be helpful. I tend to agree with Chair Patridge, outgoing Chair Patridge, knowing as little as I know about it, but that's a pretty provocative argument.
Yes, sir.
I agree with you.
Okay. Chair, you might just appreciate I'm a little concerned with the 7-member committee now doing all these store appointments. It'll take a little longer if we have that, but it'll work for us and we can make it work definitely if we have 7 members.
Okay.
Specific, I'm almost done here, financial services and the support they provide the marijuana program, audit preparation related to tax collection. As you know, they work directly with DOR. Compile cannabis tracking system data for sales compliance review. So everybody that's touching this system can stumble upon information. Here's another one that was very common is retailers. Now we're moving to retailers weren't reporting their daily sales, which is a requirement. And it was easy for the financial folks to spot this. They were able to come to public safety with the exact numbers. We were able to do outreach to get people in compliance. Those that didn't get in compliance, we were able to issue warning letters to get people in compliance, so the whole system is connected. The other big I say big because it's really time assuming, but it's not a high percentage, but we do collect cash in this industry, and people have elected to bring large sums of cash to pay for their licenses at the office. So we have to schedule those payments. It's in a secure location within the facility, and we have to have a minimum of two people, obviously reconciling that cash for verification. And then the financial coordination with public safety, like I mentioned, to the Department of Revenue, whatever information they might need for tax collection and any financial institutions that might have some questions. And you can imagine with the asks that we're talking about today will have a big impact on our human resources department. So as you know, they're responsible for hiring our new employees, filling the vacancies as they occur, running employee orientation and training, and then ongoing employee relations. And last but not least, in our general services department, the procurement and oversight of vehicle maintenance for new employees, the lease and manage of office space, and this just isn't in Portland, this would be around the state. We are running out of space, we'll need to lease space for these additional employees. And then last but not least are the new contracts and renewals of contracts. So we have, like we've mentioned, the CTS system, we have our online licensing system, and we have the online worker permit system. Those contracts will come due, whether we extend, whether we negotiate, or whether we go out for another RFP is something that General Services would take the lead on those big systems to make it, well, to actually lead the effort in any of those categories, whether we do one or all of those. So with that, I think I'm passing it over to Mr. Schutte, unless you have any more questions of me.
Do you have a plan for space acquisition? And the reason that I'm curious is we've just had a recent kerfuffle over in Madras with ODOT, and we've had presentations from DAS about how much excess space we've got all over the state and where there could be shared space, and I just don't know if you've got a facilities plan that doesn't cost us an arm and a leg. You don't have to answer now, but it'd be nice to know.
A couple things. You'll see on Bill's slides here, the map will show you the locations we want to put these individuals. Two of them are in places where we're currently going to be. Our contracts are up on our existing facilities, and we'll be able to renegotiate and find new facilities to accommodate. But we will have to do some squeezing and finding of suitable, affordable housing for them, both even in the Portland area, potentially, where we're now getting, as I mentioned, in cramped for space and parking with our all the shipping that's going on in, at Milwaukee.
Okay.
Just one.
Representative Rita.
Thank you, Chair. Just curious, are you confident that you're going to be able to find these 37 excellent employees? Any concerns? We have pretty.
I'll let Will follow up. We had trouble hiring at first. We had trouble finding the right quality of the individual, getting them through background checks. Didn't know, you know, a lot of law enforcement that tends to maybe gravitate to applications. Didn't want to work in a new ephemeral marijuana legalization industry. I think people generally have concerns about public safety. You know, there's a shortage nationally of public safety officers, so there are attractive positions that pay more out there. So we had troubles in our startup for a myriad of reasons. Some were the extent, I think, of the backgrounds we were doing it initially. But our last few pulls that we've gone through, and we're double filling on licensing positions now, which we're hiring in this inspector regime, although they won't have to be back. We're getting better candidates. We've had some good folks that came on board. We had some transfers from human resources, excellent former Coast Guard folks that are coming in. So I think I'm hopeful that we'll get established and have a durability that we're going to get the kind of candidate pool we need to pull off these positions this time around.
Thank you.
How much can DAS help you with this hiring of new employees and filling vacancies? And, I mean, you're turning into a major league HR department in and of yourselves. They're supposed to be there to help agencies. To what degree can you or are you relying on them to help you? You're all smiling.
Madam Co-Chair,
that's a bad sign.
One thing, no, I think this is good news. We talked about the compensation study that we're just going through with these two classifications. We're looking at the entire job description. And one of the things that was a challenge for us is the way the minimum qualifications was written for these jobs, it excluded people right out of the chute for probably not really good reasons.
Give an example, please.
I probably can't. I can if I go back and look. But we have, it's an automated system at DAS that look for, it's just not my expertise, but the system itself can just bump people out. I can tell you that when we started the marijuana application process, I believe we had over 300 applicants statewide for those 12 positions, or 11 positions we've talked about. We couldn't fill them all because people couldn't qualify for the jobs. So that was one of the things about how do we do a better job with DAS's help, and they've been very supportive in this, is not giving up your MQs, but not making them so stringent that you can't make decisions to bring people in to at least talk to them to get them to the first step of the process.
Is a dope conviction an automatic elimination?
I hope so.
Yeah. I don't know. Off the top of my head, I think the answer would be, depending on the circumstances, was it 35 years ago? Was it yesterday? What are the circumstances around that conviction? I think we would look at that.
I think the committee would like a written answer to that question.
Okay.
If you could get it to the professional staff, they'll distribute it. Representative Rudin.
Thank you, Chair. Just one last question, I promise. We've had a lot of discussions about our, you know, budget challenges that we have in the state, and potential, you know, hiring freezes, reductions to benefits of various kinds, and so forth. In your opinion, is there an impact on your ability to attract good candidates as a result of
hardly anything if they didn't?
I guess what I'm asking is the state still an attractive place for people to work?
Gave them the opt-outs, right?
Your opinion is fine.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, I think we have a hard time at the younger level, the millennials, in getting them into state government. I just don't think there's as much interest in that environment today. So we don't get a lot of the younger applicants in. You see a lot more retired or law enforcement people or military people that are applying for these jobs. So, yes, my personal opinion, I think that's it. I think you'd see some diversity within an older segment of the population that's interested in this job, but on the younger side of this, I don't think we see as much interest. I don't know if you'd agree with that.
Yeah, I agree with Will on that. The policy positions may be a little different, right? Or the analyst positions, we have seen younger applicants for those, but, you know, in some ways I've said, and it's a problem for us, is, you know, we tend to be sort of the public safety sort of last resort hiring. A lot of people on the edge of retirements from a public safety career coming into us. We're not on a great ladder, I don't believe, for moving from OLCC management of a marijuana program into a law enforcement program. That's not a path a new person necessarily would want to take. So we've had some difficulty.
Thank you.
I would presume that this might be an area just rife for veterans preference.
Yeah. And we do have a lot of inspectors with veterans experience that are veterans.
Yeah, that'd be great. Okay.
I'm going to pass it to my colleague, Mr. Schutte.
Mr. Schutte.
Finally, we have the final table. So we have the table here, the current positions that were allocated and granted to us in 2015-17 for marijuana, 37 total. I'll just make note that two of those positions, an HR position and a hearings AP&P, what we call them, position, were limited duration. The governor's recommended budget has recommended one position for compliance and one continuation of the AP&P position as a limited duration. The top line is the biggest part of the request. Licensed investigators and compliance investigators are the ones that are really going to be driving the revenue for this program, driving the enforcement. And then below we have the two managers, as Mr. Higlin mentioned, that will still keep us in compliance with the 11-to-1 ratio. You might note we only one manager for the first initial part of the marijuana budget. License processing and policy analysis, those are the data analysts, the compliance specialist ones that Mr. Higlin was referring to, and then the support services positions. And the total request, the governor's recommended budget is now currently $10.3 million for the marijuana program. This request is an additional $7.3 million on top of that, $5.2 million in personal services, $2.1 million in supplies and services, including purchases of vehicles, leasing additional office space. Again, at the commission and many of the field offices, we have reached capacity in our personnel, so we're looking at a point where we're going to have to find additional space to put those people, not just in the Portland area, but also in some of the field offices as well.
This wasn't new news, this backlog. So why wasn't this included in the governor's budget?
Part of it was when we developed the co-chairs, committee members, part of when we developed this budget back in November, we only were looking at maybe 1,300 applications, and now we have an excess of 2,000 applications. So it's been more of a timing thing. We thought that at this point the applications would have tapered off by now, almost leveled off, but as we continue to see them grow, we're going to continue to see the workloads grow.
I think we'll be asking the chief financial officer to comment on that as well. Do you want to do it right now or wait until?
Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, for the record, Dustin Ball is the chief financial officer, and I'm happy to address that at this point.
Sure.
During the governor's budget process, we're, as Mr. Schutte said, expecting a much lower number of licensee applications, and the actual number of licensees that we were projecting was right around just north of 1,000. The current projections are pushing that up to almost double that point. We're looking more in the 1,700 to 1,800 licensing range. During the governor's budget process, we were also assuming an 80% renewal factor. We're being more conservative, knowing that during the legislative process, come January, February, March, we would have a better idea of the number of licensing applications that were in the pipeline. And the renewals are just starting to happen. And when we were looking at the governor's budget, we balanced the budget based on the revenues that the agency was projecting, and we are allowing for roughly a 1.5 month ending balance to allow for some flexibility in where those licensing numbers actually hit.
Thank you.
And so, as Will alluded to and Mr. Marks alluded to, here's a map of the current licensees in the state of Oregon and where they're at. The applications outstanding pretty much follow the same pattern. You see a large cluster around the Portland metro area, down the I-5 corridor, and of course a large cluster of big red dots, which are mostly grow operations down the southern Oregon area. And some smaller groups around the Bend area, but for most of eastern Oregon has opted out of this program. So given that, for the compliance specialist, based on that need, we're looking at, you know, where would these people go if we got them? Because most of the work, especially, is around the Portland metro area. Six of those compliance inspectors would go to the Portland metro office, two would go to the Salem office, three towards Eugene, and four weighted down in the Medford area where most of the bigger, larger grow operations are, which are the most complex to inspect and renew. And then maybe one out in the Bend area for especially some of the area around Deschutes County.
You look as though you've been cogitating.
Well,
Representative,
thank you, Mr. Chair. This is just fascinating. So I know this is the number of licenses is going to be driven by the market. And yet you said we've gone from like 1,000 to, you know, projecting 3,000. Does the market, those people that are making those applications, do they know how many other people are out there applying for this? Because if I looked at this and was thinking about entering this business, I might change my mind if I knew that there was going to be 3,000 stores instead of 1,000.
Co-chair is Representative Reardon. I ask that myself that question every day. I was the one that came up with the original forecast of about 1,000 licensees, and now we're looking at almost twice that amount. A lot of it has to do with the openness of the Oregon markets. A lot of our estimates were based on Colorado and Washington, and there was certain restrictions on vertical integration there and market caps and that sort of thing. We have none of those in Oregon. And then part of it, too, is just the enthusiasm, I think, for the crop itself and the product. But I think a large part of it, too, is that we are beginning to see, I think, a significant amount, especially on the grow side, the producer side, medical people coming into the recreational markets. Right now, about 14% of the sales through our retail outlets are cardholders, medical cardholders. So I think you're seeing a bit of a transition there as well. So we're kind of in flux, and we're really not sure where, I'm not sure where this market's going to end up yet.
Follow.
Just clarification on what I was trying to get at. What is that market data available to those that are participating in the market?
Yes, all okay. That market data is available.
All right, thank you. Mm-hmm.
You're thinking about an entrepreneurial opportunity?
No, I'm getting out of this business.
All right, let's sprint to the finish.
Here are some of the results of the program, and I think it lines up with your recent questions about what size is the market. If you look at the results of the work we have done, you know, you can see there in the shaded area, lighter color, that OLCC started taking over and doing recreational tax sales in October. We're now, you know, we're pretty proud. I know it's marijuana, but we're proud that we transitioned through this gap without dropping off very far, and we brought it back up to the levels that it was during the rec program, about $34 million a month. We do expect April is going to be set a new record for monthly sales. So it gives you an idea about the growth of the market, but the question you're really asking is how high is that bar going to go? And I don't think we know that answer is another 10% or another 25%. Certainly, and then how much of the new retailers that come into the market are eating market share internally, and how much of that is based on growth of new market entrants in Oregon, either new, first-time, recreational folks that are exploring with marijuana recreationally, or people who are dropping their OMMP status and buying taxed recreational product now, which would actually be a very good result for the creation of the system. So the work that we're doing here, this reflects the money that comes in that supports public services for state government, for local communities today. You have the distribution, and there it is in front of you, but those are not small dollars. In a state that is strapped for cash, about $115.9 million coming in. I do believe, this is my belief, so I'll discount myself from the state official estimates, say I think there's room that these are going to come in a little bit higher here, that we can feel comfortable about that. But we don't know where that's going to lead us, and this is the reflects the official forecast. And the summary just takes you back to the beginning, and I'm have trepidation about going through it, Madam Chair. So we're self-funded. We didn't. We skipped through some slides. We do propose to, because we're in this growth mode again, and we got to front-load the licensing staff and the enforcement staff. We are proposing borrowing from the liquor fund again, fully to be repaid by the fees on the marijuana clients within or licensees within the biennium. So we'll close that gap, and if we can't, we'll raise fees and do it and make sure that we do.
Fees on?
On the marijuana licensees. So we're totally supported on licensees currently.
Has all previous borrowing from the liquor fund been repaid at this point?
No, it has not. This is that, and we talked about it before, the formula and all that issue is still out there, but they're getting closer to having some legislation that will get us, I believe, released. Senator Monroe's looking at me as if he serves on the Revenue Committee.
Thank you. I forgot I had queried you about that previously.
And we've explained the relationship and the drivers here inside our budget. It starts off with licensing. It goes to our enforcement. Enforcement helps us with make sure we're COL compliant, take care of keeping marijuana out of the hands of children, making sure there's no diversions within our system. We believe that we put together a credible package. It's based on our experience
was going to say if Bill had been more accurate the first time and estimated one inspector per 50, we would have been just right with no backlog, but we were one for 100. But we didn't know what we were going to get, and I think this gives us a reasonable program to work for the same kind of results that we got last biennium for you.
This is a question for the Chief Financial Officer. Given that the assumptions in putting the governor's budget together last fall were so erroneous, should we look for the governor's advocacy on this additional 7.3?
Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, for the record, again, Dustin Ball, the Chief Financial Office, and I have been working with the agency and the Legislative Fiscal Office a little bit in helping to kind of sort through this. So we are involved in the process. Yes.
That wasn't my question.
Madam Chair, let me help. I've worked with the policy advisors, Mr. Rhodes, who is the marijuana policy advisor for the governor, is fully aware of our request, was supportive of us moving forward and making this ask to satisfy it, and hopefully that definitely translates into outward support directly to you.
Thank you. Okay. Colleagues, any questions? Yes, Senator Monroe.
Is there any ongoing discussion on merging the recreational and the medical? Because it strikes me that, if I have to have a medication, these people think they need this medication. If I have to have a medication, I have to pay something for it. So it seems to me that it wouldn't be untoward to ask the people that need medical marijuana to pay a little bit for that as well.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Monroe, that question has come up about whether you would tax medical product at all. Other states do. They have a lesser tax on it, lower tax. But no, it's not directly in front of us now. It probably would be going through a revenue committee on the House and Senate side if that were in play. As far as the committee is, we're doing less of a merger now, but the committee is going to consider if it can come together tomorrow night on tracking, making sure maybe not merging the systems entirely, but making sure all the medical production is tracked through our metric system with additional responsibilities for us. If that passes in the form that I think it's being considered, you'll see us back here again.
All right. On that note, colleagues, any other questions for this panel?
One last.
Representative Rudin.
So you track the retail and track the medical marijuana. Do we have any way to track the black market?
So Bill's the economist, but the answer to that is everyone makes estimates, and they vary wildly, and I can't give you I don't have a ballpark that I rely upon in that range of differences in the black market here in Oregon. And medical is tracked monthly and less so and more recently, and we're just starting our system. So not good estimates on the black market. People think, even from medical, it's anywhere from 25% to 75% diversion out of medical. I think the truth is way in between, not at the outer fringes. And there are estimates out there, and we can give you a variety of estimates on what the black market might be, but no one actually knows.
Okay, that's fair.
Okay. Is that it, John? Thank you for spending this quality hour and a half with us. Colleagues, any questions for this panel before we adjourn for the day? Ms. Deister, any words of guidance or wisdom?
No, absolutely none.
In that case, colleagues, we're adjourned.
Thank you. I tell you none.
In that case, colleagues, we're adjourned.